first time I went to India was when I was 2 years old. I believe it's an Indian tradition. I don't think it's a family tradition. Where the first haircut for the boys is done after about a year and a half to 2 years. And it's done via straight razor. So I was flown to India and there's some guy chopping my hair off with a straight razor and like a ton of people are watching this. And I saw the video years later. I'm like, why is this a thing? Like, I have a nephew who's about to go through the same thing. My sister's going to have it done not with a straight razor. I feel like it's kind of a smart decision, a good adaptability standpoint. And then another story. This was, I went to India when I was about 14, 15 years old. This was pre-capitalism, Narendra Modi. The roads were all still unpaved, even in the cities. There were no streetlights. The roads were filled with cars, people, merchants carrying it, their merchandise on their backs, elephants, everything. So anyway, it's very casual. There wasn't really a licensing system, so I just kind of was given the motorcycle. And so I rode the motorcycle, and I saw an elephant at an intersection in front of me, and I was going too fast because I don't know how to drive a motorcycle. They're like, oh, it's easy. Don't worry about it. It's not easy. And anyway, so I took a sharp left and crashed right into a cow. And it just wiped out. And I look up and the cow's just staring at me. He's like, why did you try and get in my way? It's like, that was the India that I like to remember. Not the new India with streetlights. The kind of boring one now. It's like where everyone's the kind of professional. And back then, literally everything went. My cousin and I got in so much trouble, but didn't really get in any trouble because, like, if you did something that you weren't supposed to do and the police caught you, the worst they'll do is just beat you. They're not going to take you anywhere, and then the parents don't hear about it. Great time. Fantastic memories.
About 95, 94, and we went back, and that was pretty much my parents were going there to live. That was the decision. Okay, we have two kids. We've done well for ourselves here in America. Now it's time to take up and move back home. And that was when we were across the street from Brightwood Elementary School. And my parents, we had had a fire before. And so at that point, my dad was like, I don't want to rebuild too much. I'm ready to go back home. So they were hopeful. And we went back. And between that time, my mom and sister and I were primarily between London and Sierra Leone. And so just going back and forth between the two countries for, I would say, about two, three years. And in that course, a lot had happened. The Civil War had, you know, it had already started, actually, before, but it had progressed into the city now, so it was moving further from the north into the city. And so that was kind of more of my, what my parents like to call my blackout area, just because I had missed a whole grade of school. I wasn't in school for about a year. Well, I was in and out of different schools. The war had started. I had, my grandma had passed during that time, and my grandma was the one who raised me. And so that transition and going between London and Sierra Leone was quite confusing for me, but that was the first time. And like, very like first memory I have of Sierra Leone is, oyster stew, because, you know, Sierra Leone's on the coast, you got the sea. And so my grandma made the best oyster stew and bread. Shout out to oyster stew and bread. Because every time I go back, that's the first request I always have.
So my first memory was 3 or 4 years after I had immigrated to the U.S. And I definitely consider Bosnia as going back home. But when I'm in Bosnia, I consider going back home to the U.S. too. I have zero distinction between the two. But my first memory I remember was when I was 11 or 12 years old, I went over there and I was with my cousins. It was the first time we were all together during the war that I could remember. And it's funny because that's the country where I felt like I lost my childhood, but it was also the country when I went back, I felt like I gained a childhood. Because, you know, in the U.S., it was just trying to adjust, translate, do this, do that. It didn't feel like I was getting that childhood. But when I went back, it was just fun and games and videotaping everyone and everything. I mean, every cow was in my camera. Like, I would literally videotape cows and cats for hours.
Welcome to First Gens. This is a podcast about first generation Americans and filling in the blanks beside the hyphen. I'm Perrin.
And I'm Sky. And you know, a wise woman once said, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. But what is home, really? What is a home? When we've been talking really every episode this season about the idea of home and the idea of our parents' home and our home here in America and trying to bridge those gaps. But kind of we want to talk this week about going home and the idea of really returning to one's roots.
Exactly. And it can be really tricky in a sense because we're both born in America. Sky and I, that's literally what we've talked about all season about being a first generation American. And though we were born here, we have such a strong connection and pull to the country that our parents are from. And really how that is such a huge part of our identity and how much that means to us as far as knowing and identifying with our roots. I went to Liberia as a baby, and I have not been back since. And so it's really, really interesting to me because though obviously I can't just say like, oh, I remember this or remember that, but I find myself dreaming about Liberia. I've always dreamt about it. And it's very interesting because when I see pictures and when I read magazines, I'm like, oh, yeah, like I know that or like I identify that or like I remember that. And so that could be a collection of just like memories and things that I've seen over the years. But at the same time, like I'm like, oh, that's home. Like, you know, obviously that's what my mother has always said and taught us, you know, home is Liberia. Mm-hmm. And so when we went back when I was a baby, it was in the midst of the first civil war. Liberia has gone through two civil wars within the past 30 years. And so when you really think about it, it's kind of heartbreaking and it can be very saddening, but at the same time, you know, or I feel like the country has so much potential and so much promise. And though I've never been in my adult life, I still feel a need to celebrate it and to want to make it better.
Yeah, I completely understand that feeling. You know, all my life, I've always heard, you know, from family members and just even random people when I told them where my parents were from, oh, well, when are you going to go back? When are you going to go back home? And, you know, you're talking about going back home as a child, as a baby. But I find myself saying, oh, I want to go back. I want to go back without, you know, the cognition of I've never been. How can I go back to a place I've never been to? But at the same time, there's just been this such a strong connection made from, you know, my parents and my family members of what Liberia is, what Liberia is like, who we are as Liberians, that I still do feel like I will be going back home if I get the chance to go to Liberia.
Yeah.
It's just so odd to me, though, to think about the idea of going back to a place where I haven't been physically, but I feel like mentally I've been there, emotionally I've been there.
Yeah.
You know, I feel so connected and so rooted there, and it's a place where I've never set foot.
It's really tough. I feel like the older that I get, you know, the more of a pull I feel. And exactly like what you said, whenever I talk to people, I've actually lied to people.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding. Like, they've been like, oh, when was the last time you went? And I'm like, oh, like, really long time ago. Just, you know, like, I went, you know, but just not recently.
Well,
like,
I mean, where I just, that's technically true.
I guess. But at the same time, a part of me is kind of embarrassed and ashamed that I haven't.
Yeah.
And I can make excuses and I can blame the state of the country. I can blame Ebola. I can blame, you know, the structure and the civilization and the huge gap that stays so visible between the upper and the lower class. I can put so many different things on it, but still feel as though, you know, well, how can it get better? You know, if we're all leaving, or if the youth that is here who are Liberian, if we're not putting back into our country, mm-hmm. then how can it ever get past this point?
Yeah, you know, brain drain.
Exactly. Like, how can we educate more Americans about Liberia and to show them that they look at America as their big sister? You know, everything from the economic to the government structure
is the flag.
To the flag, literally the flag, yeah. Red, white, and blue, just one star, is duplicated mm-hmm. from America. And so it's like, how can we not? But, you know, my mother and my sister went back maybe, I want to say, like 8 years ago. And, you know, they had their experience. And, you know, it's really interesting. Like, my mom and sister are both really happy that they went. But when they came back, they were still very sad. You know, like, my mom talked about the road and the roads. And my mom talked about how she had so many fond memories. Like, can you just imagine growing up and seeing, like, beautiful, like, palm trees and coconut trees and mango trees and farms and the beach? Like, literally, Liberia is, like, off the coast. It has the most beautiful beaches, the most beautiful tidal waves. Like, it's perfect for surfing. Like, literally, when I tell you, like, it could be a destination, like, resort. Mm-hmm. And there used to be those things. Can you imagine growing up in those things, you know, being built up and kind of existing, and then going back and seeing mold and seeing it torn down mm-hmm. and seeing where you went to school, like, it had been flooded or there's no flooring.
The buildings are crumbling.
Crumbling. And just, mm-hmm. When my mother was just talking about it, I could feel, like, how heartbroken she was. And in a sense, she kind of was so discouraged. Like, I don't know when my mother will go back to Liberia, because I felt like she was so sad. And that was the first time she had gone in over 20 years. And so then my sister had, like, not the same, but I think she had certain expectations. And those expectations weren't necessarily met. Yeah. And so it's an emotional tug. Too.
Definitely. My brothers and I have all had this conversation together. My mother, since she got to this country in 1979, has been talking about wanting to go home and to go back. And she hasn't yet. But I remember probably in my teenage years, my brothers and I talking about, I guess, trying to temper my mom's expectations, because, you know, she was still imagining and remembering Liberia as it was and as she grew up. And I remember we saw a picture of, it was Benson Street, and she'd always talked about growing up on Benson Street, Benson Street, Benson Street. And so I saw this photo online of Benson Street, like, as it was in present day. And so I'd called my mom downstairs to the computer to show it to her, just to see, like, oh, do you remember this part? And, like, to me, like, the photo looked fine. Like, there was some beautiful, like, green grasses and things like that. It was like a dirt road, but it looked fine. It looked pretty standard to me. Mm-hmm. And when she saw it, like, she started crying, because it was not what she remembered. Like, she knew exactly where that photo was taken, right. But it was just so different yeah. from how it was when she was growing up and from when she left the country. And so from that moment on, like, my brothers and I kind of had that conversation about trying to help my mom temper her expectations about what she's going to see when she goes back home. And over Mother's Day weekend, a couple of weeks ago or whenever it was, my aunt called from home. And so my aunt was living in Michigan, in Detroit. She came over in the 80s, the early 80s, and then just recently went back to live and to work in Liberia earlier this year. And so on the phone, my aunt was just like, Lena, it's not the same, you know? And she was just saying how hard the roads were, and just how it's just certain things are just not possible that they were growing up. My dad used to talk about just spending some days just outside running around, sitting underneath the mango tree and just eating mangoes. and climbing the tree and getting more mangoes. Mm-hmm. And like, that's always been like the vision of Liberia that I've had, is just like underneath the mango tree.
Yeah.
Fun fact, if you go to my Twitter account at MSkyDep, no, what is it? My Twitter account
Carolina
at Carolina Sky.
Sky,
Carolina underscore Sky. There we go. Thank you. Like for the location portion, it says underneath the mango tree, because that's how I've always pictured Liberia. Mm. And so even for me, like, I have these images of Liberia from my parents. And then whenever I see the photos of the beaches now, where people have literally been defecating and urinating into the ocean and onto the sand because there's not running water. You know, that's the only place that they can go to wash themselves or to relieve themselves. And then they're relieving themselves where they're washing themselves. And that's just the norm for folks, some folks now. And that's, it's so devastating to me. And, you know, I didn't have any experience growing up there. So I can't even imagine how difficult that is for my parents or for my family members to see that.
Yeah, you just kind of implanted like that vision in my head. It really is just disheartening. It really is. And even when we talk about, you know, this and home, we have family members who made it to America and were deported back to Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard that's for them. You know, that's a whole different experience, and how they have to start over, and how they came to this country with so many expectations, mm-hmm, of a better life and providing, because those opportunities were not back home. Mm-hmm. And then they're sent back home with not much to show for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't here for a very long time to start with.
Right.
And that in itself is another huge issue that, not obviously, that we don't just have as Liberians, that so many other first gens and, mm-hmm, just people related to immigrants have. It's a fear. It's something that kind of plagues your everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm so happy and proud that my mother has her citizenship and how determined she was to get that. But I also have family members who struggle with their green card and updating, mm-hmm, it and maintaining it and all those things. And you think about the fears that they have or the limitations that, mm-hmm, they have when it comes to jobs. And it's a lot.
Yeah. My mom didn't become a citizen until I was in my teenage years. And so I remember, like, my dad was a citizen my entire life. But my mom just was holding onto the green card because she didn't want to let go of her Liberian citizenship, because in her, mm-hmm, mind, she was going back. Like, this was all, yeah, just very temporary and just before a few years until everything got, the country got back on its feet, and then she was going to be going back.
Yeah.
And for her, I know having a green card versus having, you know, citizenship here in the States was, like, giving up her green card in some ways, I think she saw as giving up on Liberia and, like, mm-hmm, giving up hope of going back home,
yeah,
and kind of returning back to the life that she wanted to go back to. But I remember being a teenager and being seriously worried about my mom and being seriously worried about, like, whether or not she was going to stay in the country. Because there are a couple of times when there are some issues with her green card, not, like, she renewed it, but then it wasn't in the system. And you know how bureaucracy is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just like, well, what's going to happen? Like,
yeah,
is she going to get sent back? Will we see her? And so, you know, it's scary, like, to have a parent or to have a family member or a loved one who, you know, you never know where they're going to be or if they're going to be here and or sent back or if they're going to be allowed back into the country. You just never know.
You just don't know. You just don't know. And it's a privilege and an honor and a beautiful thing when first gens or just people have that opportunity to go back and, mm-hmm, to travel back and to be fully immersed in both cultures,
mm-hmm,
and to feel as though they can have a foot in each. That's something I would love one day.
Yeah. My family has always been, it's because they were the first in their families to come over to the States. And so they were always sending money back home and sending clothes back home. And so as I've gotten older and independent, like, my mom still sends barrels of clothes back home. And so I help to contribute to that, or help to contribute money when she sends money sometimes. And so I always feel so good about being able to do that, but I just know there's so much more that I could be doing.
It's just hard when you feel helpless and just kind of thinking of the smallest ways to make an impact.
This is Caleb's story.
I identify as a Japanese American. So my mother is Japanese and my father is American. Growing up, I've only lived in America and the United States, been in the same house in North Carolina my whole life. On Saturdays, I would go to Japanese school, and that's where I learned the basics, the foundations, the grammar and stuff like that for Japanese. And then since my mom was a stay-at-home mom, she would also teach me. She would make sure I got it. There's this thing called kanji in Japanese. You really have to know that in order to read the newspaper. But she would make sure, there's a test that you have to take, or it's like a kanji quiz every week. She made sure I made at least an 80 at home before I made it to school that week. So it was like the standards were really high. And then over the summer, while we have, 3-month-long vacations in America, we would go to Japan. And my mom would just enroll me into like the school, like her hometown school, the schools that she went to. And so I did that all the way up to high school. And then I ended up graduating from American high school and then also the Japanese high school. My mom, she was a foreign exchange student at UNC Charlotte, and she didn't know that much English. And my dad, being completely American, he didn't speak Japanese. So them meeting and then trying to communicate, and I know my mom always says, like, when she gets in a fight with my dad, she gets frustrated because she's kind of wondering, like, why do I always have to fight in English? Why can't I fight in Japanese? But if she said anything in Japanese, he wouldn't get it. He'd just be confused. So he did end up studying a lot of Japanese, but Japanese is very difficult to master. And he was a linguistic specialist for Delta. So he did know 5 different languages, and that's his specialty, learning languages. So he got to where he could speak Japanese pretty well, but ultimately my mom's English was better than his Japanese, so they still communicate that way. I'm technically native in both languages, but I'm better at English. So if I get mad, I would rather argue in English. So I understand where she comes from. You can't, the vocab that you use to express your emotions, when you're mad, you can't do that in a foreign language. So it's the miscommunication between the two. It would be really difficult. Growing up, I identified more with my Japanese side. I didn't have as many American friends, and then my best friends were at the Japanese school and go up till like middle school. So I knew all the like music, all the TV shows, the games. They record different Japanese TV shows and they rent them out here. There's a store that does that. So my mom would get that. And I think that was another major thing that helped me learn, because you know the language doesn't mean you understand the culture. And then being able to watch the TV shows and then what's trending and what is everyone talking about during that time really helped me, befriend people in Japan and kind of understand, they're what they're talking about, their slang and stuff like that. So I always think when I go to Japan, I love how I know the culture. I know I can speak it. I can connect with different people because I know so many other half Japanese children that don't speak any Japanese, and they go to Japan. They tell me how they only speak to their grandma in English. The grandma doesn't understand any English, so it's just gestures. That's how they communicate. And I always feel really bad for them that they didn't, learn it. I did make a lot of sacrifices growing up trying to learn the language and the culture, but I think ultimately it was worth it, and that going and being able to fully understand both cultures is very important. I think I was in kindergarten, and I knew somewhere that I had been there before, but this was like the most vivid thing that came to me. So it was like my second year in kindergarten, and then getting to go to Japan was like the biggest treat. Even though I had to go to school when I was in kindergarten, it didn't really matter. I just loved going there, got to see my grandmother, really good food, and then my best friends were there, and I only got to see them once a year, so it didn't feel like, oh, you're going there to study. So yeah, especially in kindergarten, it's more just socializing with other people. I never felt any discrimination. We do live in, when I go to Japan, it's a very small town in the middle of nowhere. And so when I got there, it was like the teachers loved me. They were impressed that I could speak Japanese. And there's nothing but positive memories from back then. Something that's changed from when I was younger to now. When I was younger, well, my mom made sure, since we, I guess this is the same in American culture too, but when you're in the middle of nowhere, in the countryside, you tend to say good morning or good afternoon to everyone you see. There's not that many people. It's just a friendly thing to do. And especially that's true in Japan. So growing up, I said good morning, good afternoon to everyone I see. And the town I'm in is full of a bunch of old people. They're very old there. So they would respond to me. I think, so when I was younger, I looked a lot more Japanese. I probably could have passed for 100% Japanese. And then as I got older, especially like last year or the year before, I still do it. I still say hello or good afternoon. But since Japan is such a homogenous country, society, that when I go, I know I look pretty Asian when I'm over here, but when I go to that town in Japan, it's like, he is the only white dude here. He's the only American. He looks so out of place. And so even though I'm speaking to them in perfect Japanese, sometimes like the older people won't respond to me. It's not anything like they're slightly judging, like, oh, he's just saying it just to say it, or they're really surprised to see someone that's not Japanese here. So that is something that I guess I've noticed change. I personally don't like it. I love saying something to people and I want them to say something back, but I understand it. I know where they're coming from because I look so foreign to them that they're probably thinking, oh, he's just saying it just to say it. We can't really keep up a conversation. I identified more with my Japanese side, and I guess that's because I look more Japanese and people accepted me more. And not that they don't accept me anymore, but it's more like, wow, you're mixed. Why can you speak Japanese? Why are you so fluent in this language that we speak? And so from there, it kind of shifted more to because I live in America, I've shifted more to my American side. In America, you're the melting pot, you know, they don't judge you as much. Like, you're pretty normal, even though, regardless of what race you are, you're not out of place. So I guess it's easier to feel more comfortable in America, where it's more acceptable to be different than it is in Japan. So a lot of things that are popular from Japan and America are like anime, manga, I guess sushi. And with the anime and manga, I feel like it's given a negative stereotype, negative connotation to Japan. I have nothing against anime and manga, but I feel like it's like, oh, Japan is the land of cartoons or a lot of weird voices and stuff like that. And so it kind of bugs me that that's what people think about when they think about Japanese. And that was part of the reason why I kind of suppressed, like, oh yeah, I'm half Japanese, or that I speak Japanese when I was younger. But I think that because they have those different types of things in America, by having a slight interest or gaining some kind of knowledge on Japan and then using that to, you know, explore further what Japanese culture is like, I think that part is good. But I think there could be better examples of Japanese culture within American society rather than just manga or anime that characterizes Japan. I like educating people on, you know, Japan's culture and their stereotypes, and kind of fixing that and making sure that they understand that it's not just anime or manga, there's more to it. Also, it doesn't go just from the American side, the Japanese side as well. They have this huge stereotype about America and stuff like that. I used to always say going back home. I don't know. It was more like a word, I guess, since my mom would say it, we're going back home. And then as I got older, I would use it without even realizing. I'm going to go back home to Japan. And people would be like, but you live here. Like, what do you mean by go back home? To me, it's just a word. I consider both places my home. I've spent enough time, in my opinion, in Japan to call it my home. I have just as many friends there as I do over here. So it's not even like a second home. I guess it's the same feeling as it is in America. And it's just fun to go both places. I was a double major. I did management and Japanese originally. So I guess I'm kind of a pushover. Didn't know what I wanted to do when I got there. And so my uncle, my American uncle, was like, you're going to do management or you're going to do business, anything business. And then since you already speak, you're already native in Japanese, obviously you're going to do that. And so looking back, I kind of slightly regret it, I guess, because I already speak it. I kind of wanted to add, like, I wanted to be trilingual. But yeah, I want to add Spanish to it. But it opened up so many opportunities for me, but just being able to speak Japanese, I was able to become like the president of the Japanese club there. And it was a quicker progression than it would have been if I were to double major in something else. And I probably wouldn't have double majored if I weren't for the Japanese. Going through school, I was going to become a project manager and maybe try to use my Japanese somewhere there. But as I got through school, I did 3 internships, and I realized I do not want to sit at a desk all day. I have so many better things to do. I need to be active. I love sports, so I just need to go do something. And so I took an acting class, and I loved it. And so from there, I was thinking, yeah, maybe I can try to become an actor in Japan. I've thought about it before. I watched TV growing up, and I've always thought this is something I can do. I feel like I probably have the personality to do it. I can talk. I speak both languages. That's, I guess, a plus to being able to speak English and going over there. And so my plan as of right now is to graduate on Friday and then take maybe 2 or 3 months planning to figure out what places I need to go to audition or join an agency. And I have a few connections in Japan. So I was going to hit them up and then take it from there. I'm going to be rooming with a friend. He got a job in Tokyo. So we're going to be living together. And yeah, so it's one of my really close friends. So it's really exciting. I can't wait. Even if it doesn't work out, I can come back and say, I chased my dream. I'm a go-getter. I speak 2 languages, and that I gained the like social skills and the presentation skills from, you know, being an actor and performing. So I think this is the way to go. Maybe, I guess I'm generalizing too, but I feel like starting my career in Tokyo, it seems easier to act in Japan. It seems like, well, ultimately LA, Hollywood, that's like, you're the top of the top, the best of the best. And so I don't have that experience. I'm business and Japanese, taking 2 acting classes. So I think that was my ultimate goal, is to go to Japan. And so there's 2 routes that you can take. You can take the acting route or the TV personality route. And I think I'd probably be better at the TV personality route. I've thought about that. But with the acting route, I can do both. I can be on TV, I can act, and then say like a Hollywood film, they need some Japanese actors. I can take that and I won't be stuck on TV or a TV show that I have to be on every week. So taking that and coming, maybe gaining a lot of experience in Japan, quality experience, quality acting experience, and then if seeing where that goes, I think I have a shot in LA, maybe going out there. But mainly the overall thing is getting experience, figuring out, I may not even like it. If I don't like it, I can come back and I'll go the whole business route. I'm fine with that, but you never know till you try, so. What makes me most proud about being Japanese American would be being able to identify with more than one culture. I think it's more fun. It opens up your perspective to everything. I think I'm more open-minded because I know both cultures. And just having, I guess, it's still one identity, but I have 2 things that I can relate to. I guess that would be it.
Sky and I are actually back, and we wanted to make a big announcement. We're gonna go back to Liberia. We're gonna go home.
I'm sorry, I don't know what to say.
You're supposed to say something.
I just realized that. I was like, oh, shit.
You're supposed to talk.
I know. I'm sorry.
Did the reality just hit you that hard?
It did. It's just, I've been thinking about this for my entire life and dreaming about it for my entire life. And so the fact that we have this plan, and then I can truly say I'm, the second time I go, that I'm going back home because
but you're real about it. Because right. You're actually going.
Yeah, I'll be real to it.
You'll be real to it. So we're so excited about this, guys. This is our official announcement. This is the first time we've said it out loud and mm-hmm. the first time that we've stuck to it. And we would love your support. We would love anything that you can give, whether it's advice, whether it's tips, whether it's flights, whether it's anything.
Yes.
We would be so appreciative, and it would literally mean the world to us.
Mm-hmm.
We have created a GoFundMe account. You can go to www.gofundme.com/firstgens. That's number one, STGENS. And honestly, guys, we would be thankful for anything.
Yes.
Anything that you can give, we would be so blessed beyond measure, because this trip means so much, because not only would it be our first time going to Liberia as adults, but we can actually talk to the young people in Liberia and really figure out where they are. We want to be able to tell their stories. We want to be able to relate that back to Americans, you know, young American people,
mm-hmm.
and be able to show even more parallels. The country is going to be going through their presidential elections in October. And that is going to be a huge change. That's going to be a huge shift, as we know. And we just want to be able to share that with everyone.
Yeah, and this will be the second president to come into office since the Civil War. And so this is a really big deal. This is really going to be a making or breaking point for Liberia. And so, you know, that's also why we realized that we need to hurry up and go, because God forbid something bad happens. We need to be able to have said that, you know, this is a lifelong dream of ours, and so we can't keep putting it off any longer.
We can't. So we would love your help. We always appreciate your support, and we're excited to go home.
Yes!
If you enjoyed what you heard, subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Like, if you haven't already, what exactly are you waiting for? It helps other people find us. We can also be found now on Radio Public and wherever else you get your podcast. Make sure to leave a review or comment on social media. We'd love to interact with you too. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FirstGens. That's number one, STGENS. Plus, get tons of bonus content on our website, firstgenspodcast.com. First Gens was created by Perrine DeShield. The show is co-hosted by Perrine and Sky Wilson. Trey Pierce, aka Self, is our audio engineer. Nick Stubblefield is our official composer and created the lovely music you heard throughout this episode. Thanks to our roundtable guest, Betty, Alvita, and Sean. And a special thank you to Caleb for sharing his First Gen experience. First Gens is a proud member of Huga, an amazing co-working space based out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you so much for all of your love and support.